Good music is what we want to hear.
What do you mean, good music?
It's what we dance to, what our children will dance to. And if you don't want to play it, then take your records and go home.
Did you have a band? Good or bad?
It's a great band. It's a bad band. It's like pizza, baby. It's good no matter what. There's music in the air.
Welcome to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. I'm Jim DeRogatis, the pop music critic at the Chicago Sun-Times.
And I'm Greg Kot. I write about rock and roll for the Chicago Tribune. Today on the world's only rock and roll talk show, one of the great singers of our time enjoying the biggest success of her career is with us live in the studio, Nico Case.
Plus, we'll be reviewing the new albums from the much-hyped English singer Amy Winehouse and hip-hop superstar producer turned rapper Timbaland.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and time now for some music news.
It's an unlimited supply, and there is no reason why. I tell you, it was all a frame. They only did it because of fame. Who? EMI. EMI.
Less than 2 months ago, Apple CEO Steve Jobs called on EMI and the other three big record labels, Vivendi Universal, Sony BMG, and Warner Brothers, to drop digital rights management software, anti-piracy software, from all of its online music sales. This week, EMI complied with Jobs' request by saying, yes, we are going to drop all of those digital rights management, DRM, restrictions on our back catalog. Basically sell our entire catalog to consumers with no restrictions at all. In other words, consumers will now be able to download songs from the EMI catalog, copy them as many times as they wish, and play them on any digital player. In addition, they are going to be offering these digital files at a higher bit rate. In other words, the sound quality of these files is going to measurably increase and double the bit rate per second. So, of course, this comes with a price increase. We couldn't give this away for free. Jobs is going to charge 30 cents more per digital download. That's a pretty steep increase from 99 cents per file to $1.29 per music file.
Can I inject a bit of history here?
Yes.
Do you recall when compact discs were introduced? The pledge was this technology right now is more expensive than vinyl LPs. It's going to take a while, but once it becomes the new standard and the sound's going to be so much better, the prices will come down to meet the level of what the vinyl LPs you're buying now are. Never happened. Music industry to this day has a million reasons for problems in the business. You know, and a big one was that it went from $10 to buy a vinyl album to $15 to $18 to buy a CD, and it never came back down. We are now seeing that in the realm of the digital download.
Exactly. EMI and Apple hailing this as a major step forward in the music industry, and they have to, because the music industry has been in a 7-year decline of CD sales, as we've been reporting on Sound Opinions, and this is seen as the future of the music business. But two interesting things about this press conference, Jim. First of all, they're making it seem like we're giving consumers this big new development. In other words, you're going to be able to get these music files. You're going to be able to copy them as often as you want. You're going to be able to share them with friends. You're going to be able to play them on any device. Well, they have a little thing called the CD that already does that.
Well, yeah.
I mean, and now they're charging us 30% more to give us something that we already have,
right,
with a CD. Any old CD will do
no,
that
it's
already.
That's absurd. I mean, if I buy a tune for my iPod, I should also be able to play it in my bathroom clock radio or whatever. Why not?
Absolutely. And the second thing is, What is unique about this press conference? Jobs, this is an EMI press conference, right? They're making this announcement, but Jobs is up there as virtually a peer of the EMI CEO, Eric Nicoli. In fact, in some ways, it's kind of like Nicoli doing Jobs' bidding. I mean, Jobs made a big deal about calling for this 2 months ago, saying, remove these copyright restrictions from these digital files. Now Nicoli's making this announcement, and he calls Jobs in. You know, it should be pointed out that all digital music stores will have access to these restriction-free music files, but only Jobs and only Apple were part of this music conference.
Yeah.
So what is that telling you?
It tells me that Jobs thinks he's Bono.
I think Jobs thinks, and with good reason, that he's running the record industry right now. The record industry is turning Jobs and saying, you're the future, my man.
Yeah.
You get our stuff, and you get first crack at it.
Well, there's still one huge exception here. What is the jewel of the EMI catalog? Capital EMI. the Beatles, right? Still no Beatles. Why? What's going on with that? Why are there no Beatles available on digital download?
It's kind of surprising in some ways because you would think that the Beatles, being the businessmen that they are, would have taken advantage of this opportunity, but I think they're still very skeptical. As we have reported on Sound Opinions, the Beatles' Apple recording company and Steve Jobs' Apple computer company have been jousting about the name. That lawsuit was recently settled. Apparently, that paved the way for the Beatles to make their music available on iTunes. That has not happened yet.
I have another theory. I think that they're going to want to see how this new higher-priced download, so it's increasing from 99 cents to $1.30, right?
Yeah, $1.29.
I think the Beatles are thinking we can get $1.50, $1.60, $2 a tune. That's
sure.
What I think we're going to wait and see.
And I think what we're seeing here, Jim, is a way overpriced product. I mean, instead of coming down in the price of an individual download, we're raising the price now?
Yeah.
I mean, it seems to be a trend that's going in the wrong direction. And I think if the music industry thinks this is the future by raising prices of digital files, they're absolutely wrong. They're still getting files for free on the internet. I mean, we're talking about tens of millions of files being shared every month on the internet, and that has only increased in recent years. I don't see this as a step in the right direction for the music industry.
They tried to make me go to rehab. I said no, no, no. Yes, I've been black, but when I come back, no.
That is Amy Winehouse, the opening track on her second album, Back to Black. It's called Rehab, as in, she ain't going there. Apparently, by all accounts in the English press, the 23-year-old London bad girl and soul pop sensation could use a little bit of rehab. She is a hard-drinking, hard-drugging, hard-living, nasty-talking woman. She's tough stuff. And the English are in love with her. Greg, you know, it is often said that the United States and Great Britain are two countries separated by a common language. And in culture, occasionally we have these phenomenons that are huge in the United Kingdom. And, you know, I just don't know how they translate in the U.S., if at all. When we were at South by Southwest in Austin, Texas a couple of weeks ago, Winehouse was definitely one of the biggest hypes of the year. I didn't get to see her perform. I don't know if you did. But her picture was everywhere. Everybody was talking about this record. It is the second record, as I said. The first one was more on the jazz tip. She comes from that, grew up in a situation where her family, a lot of her family members were jazz musicians. She was steeped in it. Let's hear a track from the album. We're going to hear You Know I'm No Good. Here it is from Back to Black on Sound Opinions.
Meet you downstairs.
Winehouse with a track from her new album Back to Black. It's called You Know I'm No Good. Guess what? It's set in a bar. And it references Tanqueray. And Amy Winehouse, I mean, you think that's a stage name. I believe that's her real name, right, Jim? Isn't that her given name?
I think so.
Very bizarre. 23 years old. She is all over the tabloids, as you mentioned, in the UK. Not only for her singing, but for her boozing and her bad-mouthing people all the time. And this record is full of those true life tales. She's doing a lot of bad-mouthing here and a lot of regretting the morning after, and there's a lot of booze in between.
I do love the story about how she told Bono to shut up at one of the award shows. I pat her on the back for that. I got to say, I'm jumping on you. You're going to give your opinion, but I hate this record.
Oh, you know, I didn't think it was as bad as I thought it was going to be. I thought, oh, my God, this is going to be horrendous. She's referencing all of these soul and girl group heroes from the 60s and 70s.
Ray Charles, Donny Hathaway.
She was way too young to have grown up with these artists. This is clearly a second, third-hand kind of reference that she's you know, mentioning people like Donny Hathaway, and she's referencing a Billy Paul song, and she's trying awfully hard to sound like the Shangri-Las, and her producers are enablers in this. I mean, they are totally conjuring up these early 60s to late early 70s soundscapes that were very much associated with that sound, that girl group sound, that soul sound of that era. Mark Ronson in particular, as one of the key producers on this record, he's done a lot of really important work in the last couple of years with a diverse group of artists, really nice work. But this sounds like a slavish imitation to me. It feels like this 23-year-old woman from England playing dress-up. And I can't get over the fact that, oh, my God, she's trying to sound like Nina Simone, but she hasn't lived Nina Simone's life.
No, I'll tell you, there's a line in that song we just played, You Know I'm No Good, that sums it all up for me, where she says, by the time I'm out the door, you tear me down like Roger Moore. And it's a very Shirley Bassey-sounding classic 007-era soundtrack. Right? But now, if you're going to drop Bond's name. You mentioned Sean Connery, right?
The real
Not
Bond.
Roger Moore. So everything throughout this album is a little bit off.
Yeah.
It's just a little wrong. And her apologists in the British press, and now it's spreading to the U.S., a lot of critics are saying she's schooled in hip-hop. She name-drops Slick Rick as well as Donny Hathaway, right? So it's really a hip-hop attitude. It's not retro. It is retro. She's trying to be Nina Simone. She's trying to be Shirley Bassey. She's not sultry enough or subtle enough or original enough to even walk anywhere in those people's shadows. It's a transparent retro shtick, you know, and I think it's a trash it record.
I think this is a total ripoff, and I don't understand what all these critics are seeing in this record. Back to Black, a trash it record all the way.
The most tender place in my heart is for strangers. I know it's unkind, but my own much too dangerous. Hanging round the ceiling half the time. Hanging round the ceiling half the time.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and that's a little bit of Nico Case.
Nico Case having a great year. Fox Confessor brings the flood. Her fifth album has produced a tour that has been going on for about a year now, selling out shows all around the country. In the second half of this year, she will be touring with her other band, the New Pornographers, not too shabby of a band itself. Nico Case having an incredibly busy year.
Nevertheless, Greg, she found time to stop by Sound Opinions with two of her bandmates and play some tunes and have a chat with us.
We are here with Nico Case and two members of her band. Kelly Hogan is here and Paul Rigby as well. Welcome to the show, folks.
Thank you.
Nico's in the midst of a grueling tour here. Three nights at the Park West in Chicago. She's touring all over the country. Still on a record called Fox Confessor Brings the Flood that was released last year. So, Nico, I guess it would be safe to say that this is among the most successful, if not the most successful records you've ever put out.
Yeah, it's definitely the most successful one I've ever put out. Where it stands in the rest of the world, it's probably pretty meager. But for me personally, it's not really like my thriller yet. We'll see what happens.
No, it was very well received. And I think we should start by the fact you are holding an instrument in your hand right now. You've got a four-stringed guitar, which I believe is called what? That's a tenor guitar?
It's a tenor guitar, yes.
Originally a punk rock drummer from the Pacific Northwest. Mm-hmm. And then celebrated for your singing voice. And now you're playing this new instrument here. How did you come to develop your chops, your Steve Howe guitar solo chops on the four-string tenor guitar? Because it's really been key.
I like to think of myself as more of a Paul Butterfield of guitar. No, I have really tiny fingers, and I tried to play six-string for a lot of years, and I never really got anywhere because I couldn't stretch out enough to make anything that really sounded like an actual song, because you kind of have to get to that point to keep yourself interested in what you're doing. So I kind of tried and gave up a lot of times. And then I went to record part of Furnace Room Lullaby at a studio in Toronto called The Gas Station that my friend Don Kerr runs. And he plays tenor guitar, and he had some laying around. And I said, oh, what's that? It's a tenor guitar. And then the clouds parted, and oh. It's just about making that little bit of progress. It's like the training wheels guitar, you know, to where you can finally be upright by yourself without your dad holding your seat.
Right, right. Well, the reason I bring it up, it seems to me like, has that been a key for you in terms of the songwriting? Because with each album, it seems like you're playing a bigger and bigger role, and not just as a singer, but as a songwriter, as well as a producer. And has the guitar been a key in making that transition into writing more original songs?
Yeah, definitely. I'm a lot more in charge of my own phrasing vocally when I do a lot of the writing on the guitar, but on this last record, I actually wrote with other people more because I felt kind of lonely. So I'd still write on the guitar with them, but often I would fire myself from playing guitar on the actual song on the record. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I still played a lot of guitar on the record, but not as much as I did on Blacklisted.
Why don't you guys play us a tune, and then I'd like to talk a lot more about the songwriting on Fox Confessor Brings the Flood. Are you going to play something from that album, or what are you going to give us?
Let's do Teenage Feeling okay. First, and I don't actually play guitar on this one, so you guys can mute it if you want.
Ready,
then?
Mm-hmm. Three.
That teenage feeling. Kelly Hogan, Paul Rigby, and Nico Case.
You're listening to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media, and we're going to be back with more of our conversation with Nico Case, plus a live performance.
So suddenly, the madness came with its whiskered woven ease of pains. He locked the door and he shut the blinds. He laid down on the floor and he slept like iron while the dirty knife bored deep into his spine. Blood runs crazy
grass is high, the cats are wild. You can't even touch the tip of their tails, and the blood runs crazy with giant strides. For Polly, everything's so easy for Polly.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. We have more of our discussion with Nico Case. I asked Nico about whether or not her new album, Fox Confessor Brings the Flood, is her darkest. I thought this was your darkest album. There were murder ballads and twistedness and... And you said, no, it's my most smart-ass album.
Kinda. It's my most smart-ass album, yeah, for sure. But I don't know, when you write the songs yourself, you know, you're kind of laughing about stuff, and then people come back and they go, ooh, that's icky. That's scary. And then you think, oh, I guess it must be.
Well, you had said that a lot of the lyrics were inspired by Russian and Ukrainian folktales that mm-hmm. came down from you to you from your grandparents.
Well, more that I read, my grandparents are Ukrainian, but they try to hide it as best they can. They won't speak it or talk about it. But I realized making this record that the way they tell stories is still very Ukrainian in that they like to leave a lot of things open-ended, and they kind of focus on the more fabulous angles of things. Mm. You know, just, he went crazy. I don't know. There must have been fairies, or I don't know what they think. But they like to leave things pretty open ended. She was wearing a cape and burning the furniture. That was the last we saw Aunt Dee Dee.
Yeah, that's a whole concept album right there.
She doesn't mention the part about the fact that there was lead in the drinking water or something. You know, it's just. Something magical happened. Something evil.
So when you're getting these kind of, using these folk tales, and the album is sort of made to look almost like a book of short stories, mm-hmm. or poems or whatever, you sort of get out of the confessional, woe is me, I love you, now he doesn't love me anymore kind of mode of songwriting.
Yeah, I got a little bored with that, and I wasn't very good at it, so... I thought making up songs about other people would be a lot better. Because, you know, trying to write songs like that, I'd just sit there and go, oh, wow, wow, wow. Oh, don't you sound pathetic. And I couldn't really take myself seriously. So, you know.
What about the tune we just heard? Where did that teenage feeling come from?
Funny you should ask, and Paul hates it when people ask, because the song actually came from Paul. He was on his soapbox and he was ranting, and it was excellent.
He's flushing over there. Look at that. There's actual.
He was. No,
going
he
on.
Was talking. We were talking about being musicians and how it's really hard to live a normal life, like being married or having a family. And he goes, yeah, but I'm not going to just get married because I think I have to. And he said it exactly like that. He goes, I don't care if I ever fall in love again, is because I know what it's like, but it has to be like that, like when you're a teenager.
Uh-huh,
it was adorable. And the coolest thing anybody's ever said. Because most people are kind of into getting married, and I'm kind of not, so it makes me feel kind of like a loser.
Word. I mean, yeah. I feel you.
I know.
Not word that
I
you're
know.
A loser. Word, I feel you.
It's a beautiful song, but it's not a conventional verse, chorus, here's the bridge kind of song. And not a lot of the songs on this record are that way.
It gets in, it gets out. It's got its scuba suit on. Man, it's like an oiled seal. It just goes... And then it's gone.
That's great. But does anybody... So, Nico, does any, you know, anybody in your band or, you know, one of the people you're working with in the studio, where's the chorus here? Where's the bridge? Are we going to, you know, are you going to rework this a little bit to make it more conventional? Nobody
John,
says that.
John Rawhouse just goes, why are there so many chords? Why can't you just use three? He lives to yell at me about how many chords are used.
In addition to having difficulty playing the chords.
They're kind of in their infancy as far as their skills, so.
Are you a dictator when it comes to how the song should be played? And maybe Paul can speak to this, and Kelly, who have been in the studio with you.
Generally, the only guidance I give is, can you do that more? Will you do that more? I don't really have much musical lingo. I'm not trained or anything, so, you know, I have to make up feelings to describe. It sounds so hippie and bad. Oh, that green note, Paul. Make it greener.
Is that true, Paul? You had to play a green note on this record?
I played all the spectrum, the whole prism of colors.
What does a green note sound like? Can you play one for us, Paul?
I would think that it sounds something like that, maybe.
So what would a purple note?
Man, I get paid for this. Yeah.
Don't abuse me. I'm not a show pony.
It's an advertisement for your
dance,
your
monkey,
session.
Dance. He's not going to give away all the Paul Rigby secrets on the air. Heck. That's right. Very
well,
smart.
If he's going to change the face of guitar playing, he's going to do it on his own time. Yeah.
There you go.
He doesn't give it away.
No. Is there as much fun as we're having in the studio? Is that what it was like when you were recording in Tucson?
Most of the time, yes, and there was a couple times where poor Paul and I were kind of holed up in my house watching TV till 6 a.m., trying to finish a couple songs that we had heard so many times that we couldn't hear them anymore. So it's kind of like trying to rewire your submarine in the dark. You know, you're just under the water and you're like, we're going to drown. There's 24 men on board who are going to die if we don't do this right. And I'm going to get electrocuted because there's water all over the floor.
Why don't you guys give us another tune?
We'll do Margaret versus Pauline. How about that? Great. All right, then.
Everything's so easy for Pauline. Everything's so easy for Pauline. Ancient strings set feet light, speeders at mild grace, and a monument of tacky gold. They smooth her hair with cinnamon waves. And they placed an ingot in her breast to burn cool and collect. Fate holds her firm in its cradle and then rolls with her tender paws to save her. Everything's so easy for Pauline. Girl with the parking lot eye, Margaret is the fragments of a name. Bravery's mistaken for the thrashing in the lake of a make-believe monster whose picture is fake. Margaret is the fragments of a name. Her love pours like a fountain, her love steams like rage. Her joy aches from wanting and she's sick from chlorine, but she'll never be as clean as the cool side of satin Pauline. Two girls ride the blue line, two girls walk down the same street. One left a sweater sitting on the train, the other lost three fingers at the cannery. Everything so easy for Pauline. For Pauline. For Pauline.
Very nice.
Margaret versus Pauline. Now, see, that is not smart-ass. That's frightening. I get scared when you sing about the monsters in the lake.
Well,
and
that
the,
one's not.
And what happens? What happened to her fingers?
Yeah. I guess she got them near the machinery at the cannery.
See, that's. I don't know. That song scares me. It has from the first time I heard it. I don't know
well,
why.
You know, there are some people in the world who seem to get everything they want, and it's real easy. And then there are some people who kind of have to fight their way through it.
Yep, see, I think you're wishing the negative stuff on the one for whom it's so easy.
No, it's actually, I wrote it because of this book that I read, and there was these two characters in the book, and when I was young, I read it, and it just really bummed me out, and then I read it again when I was older, and I realized that the author did it on purpose, which was actually really interesting. He wrote the book, you know, from his point of view, and Margaret was his ex-girlfriend, and Pauline was his current girlfriend, and they used to be best friends, and now they're not friends anymore. And, you know, he was constantly complaining about Margaret and what was so icky about her, and was constantly praising Pauline and how wonderful she was. And but everything that he complained about Margaret was kind of the stuff that made her so great. Like, she was really brave, and she really... He didn't like the fact that she hung out with these roughs on the edge of town. Mm. But the fact is she kind of befriended these homeless people and was nice to them. And he just thought she was hanging out with scum. But it's never addressed in the book. So basically, you get to the end of the book and she kills herself because nobody likes her anymore. But she was actually the nice person. So he leaves it for you to figure that out, which is really great. I thought that was amazing. Yeah. But at the end, I was so mad. I was like, poor Margaret. Somebody's got to stick up for Margaret.
So you wrote this song to stick up for Margaret.
I did.
What was the book, Nico?
It's called In Watermelon Sugar by Richard Brautigan.
I
such
love that
a
dude.
Sad
oh,
book.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. He's a badass.
Yeah. All of his stories are sad, yet really beautiful. Mm.
But, you know, the one thing that's interesting to me, that there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of moralizing going on in these songs.
No.
Even though there's people getting killed, mm-mm. and there's obviously villains and heroes, and but you don't seem to be, like, casting judgment on any of them.
No, you're and just... that's what I really appreciate about Eastern European folktales, mm-hmm. Is that they're not judgmental, and they're not Judeo-Christian ethic kind of, you know, it's either has to be good or bad. It's more cautionary tales.
Right.
Kind of like Native American folklore as well. Like, they're both really heavy on the animal imagery and the anybody could screw up kind of yeah. thing, you know. It could happen to you.
Exactly. Watch out, you're next.
I know. Exactly. It could happen to you.
Well, and, you know, it's hard not to hear this album as sort of like a metaphor for what's going on in the world, too. I mean, you know, when you can have people beheaded on YouTube, you know, there's a little bit of reflecting going on here. Maybe not consciously, but it does seem to be kind of metaphorical in the way how some of these tales can sort of apply to what's going on in the world.
Well,
the
nothing was written consciously as a reaction to that, but I'm sure it is. I mean, there's a good reason that I don't watch television, and that's it right there.
Right.
So... I don't know. I mean, I'm sure you can't live in the world and not be affected by people around you, even if you're some kind of hermit who never talks to anyone else. You're still a human, and you still mm-hmm. get human signals from other places.
And yet, I think
Art Bell. I'm getting all Art Bell on you.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, watch out. Alert, Art Alert. What I'm getting at is that when you see the songs perform, or when you hear them perform on the record, there's your voice and Kelly's voice with you. It's very uplifting at the same time. There's almost like a joy there at the same time.
Well, I kind of realized, and maybe it's a bit of a device, but sad songs that are performed in a happy manner are about 8 times sadder than sad songs performed in a sad manner. But, you know, the songs weren't meant to be overly sad or bring people down. They're kind of just meant to comfort people, because that's how I feel about music, is that music for me when I was a kid was very comforting.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it was about negative things. I mean, sometimes you just like to hear that other people are feeling the same way as you, or I don't know. But at the same time, I don't like to spell it out for people either.
Mm-hmm.
I like the mystery ending. And that, you know, that's what the fairy tales are a lot like, too. They're really open-ended, so you can kind of draw your own conclusions, or there is no conclusion.
I think, Nico, you've struck a chord with rock critics. I mean, certainly, Fox Confessor debuted high, or finished high, one of the best albums of the year, according to the Village Voice poll, and dozens of critics' lists. Does that make any impact? I mean, does that freak you out at all? It's like, geez, they're all saying I'm one of the best records of the year.
It kind of freaks me out a little. I mean... those are kind of things I can't understand because they're not super tangible to me either. I mean, I notice a difference if there's more people at the show. Because newspapers and media, you know, you can hold them in your hand. It's a magazine, but it's not like a place you can go and hang out in.
Right.
It's kind of a concept in a way.
And when you're playing a place like the Park West, which is like, what, 1,100 people, and you sold out 3 nights in a row in Chicago, it's like, wow, well, at least I know 3,400 people love me.
It's like when somebody tells you how many records you've sold. I don't have, like, I'm not very good at figuring that out. I'm like, cool. But I don't, I just say it. I don't actually know what it means. I'm like, great. Woo.
But does it weigh on you when you go back into the studio? Because Blacklisted was very, very well received. And then, you know, you have to follow it up. It's time to make a new record. And mm-hmm. you're in the same position again now, you know, a couple of years later. Is somewhere in the back of your head saying, I can't suck because all these people are saying that I'm good.
No, it's me going, you can't suck or somebody's going to come and haul you away and lock you up or something. I don't know.
No, we've talked about
you can't suck or you'll die.
Are you your own harshest critic?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
If I was taking myself seriously, I suppose there'd be, I don't know, somebody talking to you for me and I would be in a bath right now.
In fact, that sounds really...
I can't be bothered to go in.
That sounds really appealing, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So when is this new album that you're in the midst of recording and not working on at the moment, but right now otherwise?
Oh, that's funny that you should ask. probably September of 2008, if things go according to plan, because September of 2007 is the new Pornographer's release. So
okay.
I got to give that one a wide berth, because we're going to be on tour for a while.
Are you going to tour with the Pornographer?
Oh, yeah.
Driving home, I see those flooded fields.
Thank you so much, guys, for coming in. Kelly Hogan, Nico Case, Paul Rigby. It's a treat.
You're welcome. Thanks for having
us, dudes.
I'm taking it. For granted, my whole life since the day I was born.
On Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic. So if you have opinions about our interview with Nico Case or anything else we've covered on the show, email us at interact@soundopinions.org or leave us a voicemail on our hotline, 888-859-1800.
Coming up, we're going to review the newest from super producer and Greg's man crush, Timbaland, his much-hyped solo record, and I'll have a Desert Island Jukebox pick. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media.
What purpose in these deeds, oh Fox, Professor, please? You married me. It's not for you to know, but for you to weep and wonder when the death of your civilization precedes you.
You're listening to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. It's time to review some Timbaland.
Bounce. I ain't got no feeling. I'ma let these niggas know. Been killing them with these beats, now I'm spitting them killer flows. What you know about me, dawg? Not a damn thing. Got a problem, you can see me in the streets, dawg. I'm on one man game. I done been on both sides of the track, you can say I changed the game. A lot of niggas try to get in my lane, everybody asking me the same old thing. What they say?
That is O Timbaland from Timbaland, extolling himself, lead track on his fifth studio record, Timbaland Presents Shock Value, the highest profile release yet from Timbaland, a.k.a. Tim Mosley, 35-year-old Norfolk, Virginia native, best known as a behind-the-scenes guy in the music industry as opposed to a solo artist in his own right. You may not know who Timbaland is, but you sure as heck have heard his music. Missy Elliott, Ludacris, Aaliyah, Nelly Furtado, Justin Timberlake, countless dozens of artists who have had hits with the Timbaland production touch in the last decade. Basically, since 1996, he has been one of the dominant producers in the business. And for my money, Jim, the best. Not only getting commercial sales, but really pushing the edge of what pop radio will allow. Avant-garde production approach, off-kilter beats, sci-fi sound effects, just really odd soundscapes that he's managed to turn into commercial gold. I think
really
he's had the best of both worlds.
What those electronica techno artists, you know, I mean, in some ways there's a lot of Aphex Twin in what he's doing,
absolutely.
But he's doing it in the pop spectrum.
I mean, we brought it all the way back when we did the Revolver show on the 40th anniversary of the Beatles recording Revolver, one of the most innovative production records ever. You can draw a straight line, I think, from what the Beatles and George Martin were doing in the studio in the 60s to what Timbaland is doing in the studios now in the 21st century. I think he's that good. And now he's a solo artist. He's had one of the biggest years of any producer ever with the huge hits last year for Nelly Furtado and Justin Timberlake. He's been featured on the Timberlake tour this spring. In the middle of Timberlake's set, Timbaland takes the stage and does like a 30-minute DJ set, which isn't exactly the high point of that show. Shows you what kind of esteem an artist like Timbaland is held when an artist like Justin Timberlake gives over a good chunk of his show to him.
And now he's gearing up Timbaland to work with Coldplay.
Yeah, I mean,
along with Brian Eno.
Everybody wants to work with this guy, it seems. He's had four releases prior to this, none of which were particularly high profile, but now everybody's paying attention to Timbaland. They want to know what he's doing. He's dialed up his Rolodex and brought in all his all his friends.
Everybody who ever owed him.
Everybody,
and then some.
Exactly. Everybody who ever owed him, except Jay-Z, I heard. Jay-Z thing didn't work out, but just about everybody else that he has worked with. Let's play a track from Timbaland Presents Shock Value with two of those friends, Justin Timberlake and Nelly Furtado on Give It To Me.
Back to Montauk on law. Love my pet, but my abs in the video are promiscuous. My style is ridiculous.
Give It To Me by Timbaland from Timbaland Presents Shock Value. Greg, as you said, he's done what are essentially solo albums several times in his career before, usually with his buddy, this rapper, who's strictly a B-level talent, Magoo.
Yeah.
You know, this is the first time where Timbaland is in the spotlight because of his phenomenal successes, and this is going to be like his first real solo album. And what does he do with it? Well, it's weird. That's one of the pleasures on this album, what we just heard, Give It To Me. Although, lyrically, it's got some problems. I'll talk about that in a minute. First off, what does he do musically? First third of the album is devoted pretty much to hip-hop club jams. Middle third of the album is devoted pretty much, and this goes pretty evenly, right down into thirds, mid-tempo R&B, very snoozy. Last third of the album, we're in outer space. He's doing these weird rock pair-ups. He does a track with the Swedish garage band The Hives. He does a track with Chicago pop punk's Fallout Boy that sounds like a reject from their recent disc. He pairs up with Elton John. And as I said, he's getting ready to work with Coldplay, so he has this band One Republic come on and do a fake Coldplay song. It's weird. It's not successful. The R&B's not very good. The first third of the album is pretty strong with tracks like Release and Give It To Me and Bounce. But Timbaland shouldn't rap. He is not a good rapper. He's even worse as a singer. And even more disappointing than being a mediocre talent, because let's face it, Kanye West is a great sonic architect too, but not necessarily a wonderful rapper. Timbaland has nothing to say. he devolves into this tawdry sexism of the basest, most cliched sort. And then, on top of that, in between, he's taking a little breaks to tell us how great he is again and again and again. We even just heard some of that. I get $500,000 for my beats. You get a couple of grand. You know, he's picking a fight with fellow producer Scott Storch. Mm-hmm. You're Timbaland, man. You are king of the mountain. You don't have to keep telling us how great you are, and you don't have to lay into that horn dog routine.
No.
So bass, it's, man, what if anything, it makes me admire him less.
Yes, it is disappointing. I mean, he is not a rapper. Kanye West, I think, has actually proven himself to be a pretty credible rapper. The personality is there. Timbaland's personality, on the other hand, is kind of depressing on this record. In the past, he'd come across as sort of this cuddly, otherworldly kind of guy. This one, he's petulant, self-aggrandizing. I mean, some very unattractive traits are coming out in this record. He also doesn't seem to know how to deal with these collaborators. Are they full-fledged collaborators on this record, or are they just pieces in this big chess game that I'm playing on my solo record? He's not really clear about that. I think Furtado and Timberlake and Missy Elliott, the big three guest stars on this record, have all done much better work with Timbaland on their own respective releases. And they're sort of in the background on this particular
release. Well, yeah, I was doing some research when I was getting ready to review this album, and I read some reviews where all of those artists you just mentioned talked about working with Timbaland. And one of the things they say about Tim Mosley is he is a true collaborator. He drew things out of me that were there that I wouldn't have emphasized, but he heard.
Right.
So one of his strengths as a producer is drawing great things out of the people he's working with. But I think you're right. They all came into his project and figured, I'm here to help you. You made me a millionaire.
Yeah.
You made me on the top of the charts. What do you want from me? And he was like, I don't know. I don't think he knows who Timbaland is.
I don't think he knows either. You're absolutely right. Ditto for those rock tracks. I was intrigued. What is Timbaland going to sound like with the Hives? Well, not too interesting.
No.
I mean, he turns the Hives, you know, he turns Pelly of the Hives, one of the most dynamic lead singers of the last decade, into a background singer.
Just shouting out
some chanting
stuff.
Some stuff on the back of this track.
I really want to get to know you. That's what I told you. Girl, you know I don't play. I want to put it in your mouth. Girl, you better do what it's all say.
I think, Greg, we rate things, buy it, burn it, trash it. It pains me to say it. This is a burn it record at best, maybe even a trash it.
Yeah.
That first third is why I'm giving it the burn it. The second two-thirds of the album stink.
I think it's a trash it, Jim. I think.
Oh, I know it kills you to say that, too.
It does. I think he's a major, major artist. This is a huge disappointment. But I can't help but think that every one of these artists has done better work somewhere else with Timbaland, you know, and on this record they come together, and it's just a huge disappointment.
That's a trash it from Greg. It's killing him to say it. I'll stick with Burn It, but only the first third of the record.
I tell you, little buddy, this whole island is bewitched.
Remember, we were shipwrecked together.
Time to pop a quarter in the Desert Island Jukebox, and this week it is Jim DeRogatis' turn.
Well, Greg, we've had a lot of Nina Simone seeping through the cracks on this show. Amy Winehouse wants to be Nina Simone. The track we started our Timbaland review with, he was sampling Nina Simone. Look, I am all for referencing rock's past, but I want to know that we are living in the present and we are moving toward the future. And I think that all the stuff that's being said about Winehouse and bringing this hip-hop attitude to the classic early 60s, it's all a load of hooey, okay? I'll give you a band that did it a couple of years ago and did it better, Portishead. Portishead was an interesting collaboration, an English duo that came out in the midst of a movement that was dubbed trip-hop, kind of taking some cues from American hip-hop, but making it English, swirling and psychedelic and a little lazier, a little more laid back, very bucolic and mother country, you know what I mean? Jeff Barrow was a really talented young guy at the time. He was from Bristol, England, which was trip-hop central. He got his start making tea for the members of Massive Attack in their studio. They were really the cornerstone band of trip hop. He went on to contribute some to Nana Cherry's Homebrew album. Remember that one? I wanted to play that one. I'm going to have to save that for another week. Then he decided to make some music of his own, and he got together with a woman named Beth Gibbons, who was only 20 at the time. He auditioned some 20 vocalists, and he loved her. She was doing this bluesy kind of torch song balladry in a cover band in Bristol. So the two of them got together, and what they were doing was building on that kind of cinematic James Bond soundtrack, Shirley Bassey, Space Age Bachelor Pad, cocktail music thing, swinging London in the early 60s, pre-mod revival and soul and R&B, taking that and mixing it with this American hip-hop as filtered through a very English, laid-back, melodic, psychedelic sensibility. I think it was an incredible sound. It turned out to be a fairly limited sound. Portishead never really got any better than their first album, but boy, was that first album a masterpiece. And I'm going to play as my Desert Island Jukebox track the song Sour Times. Thanks for indulging me, Greg. That's Portishead. The track is Sour Times from Dummy. 1994, that album came out. Seems like just yesterday.
Hard to believe. Great choice, Jim, and I do love that record, and the tour after that was mind-blowing. I wish that band would come back together, and I understand they are working on some new material, so we'll see.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, because they played live with a band. They didn't just do it with samples,
yep.
So it was good stuff. What do we got next week on the show?
A man who never used samples, Booker T. Jones. He was one of the great Hammond organ players of all time and played a bunch of other instruments as well, too. The backbone of the Stax record sound of the 60s. We had the privilege of interviewing him at the recent South by Southwest Music Conference, and we will bring you the highlights of that interview next week.
Greg, we have some thank yous to say on the way out. As always, Sound Opinions is expertly produced by Todd Bachman, Matt Spiegel, Jason Saldana, and Robin Lynn. We get some legal help from Dino Armiros. Nico Case's performance was recorded by Mary Gaffney and Sarah Toulouse. And our fearless leader is Tori Southside Malatea, who I think was supposed to be on that Timbaland record.
On Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic. So give us a call on our hotline, 1-888-859-1800.
Hey, how you doing? Sorry I can't get through. Why don't you leave your name and your number, and I'll get back to you.
New messages.
Hello, this is Paul from Chicago, and this is my Sound Opinion. I'm calling about the March 31st show, where you discussed the Copyright Royalty Board hearings. I'm a member of the local bluegrass band Tangleweed, and we've really benefited from having our music played on internet radio. Earlier this year, one of the bookers for the Wakarusa Festival, which is a major festival down in Lawrence, Kansas, he heard us on Pandora.com. He liked what he heard, and after doing a little bit more research, he gave us a call and hired us to come down and play their 2007 festival. For a band like ours that played regional and local festivals last year, the equalizing elements of internet radio has really given us a boost into bigger and better opportunities. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Hey, this is Joe from Oak Park. Just wanted to thank you guys for exploring the Elephant Six catalog. I absolutely love Neutral Milk Hotel and Libby Tremor Control, constantly playing them for my friends who have never heard them, don't know how they miss such great bands. So it was wonderful to hear it on the air, and hopefully we can get more people listening to that great stuff from the mid-90s. Take care. Bye.
Hi, my name is Tracy Harkins from Chicago, and I just wanted to call and thank you guys for talking about the bands that are very important to me. As a person who has pretty much had their life changed by Neutral Milk Hotel, I truly appreciate profiling Elephant Six. Thank you.
Hi, this is Ken Krimstein. I'm calling from New York City. I had never heard of Rhyme Fest.
Straight out of high school, we didn't know what to do. Wanted to go to college, but no money was nothing new. Wanted to get away, go see the world and do something new. He got approached in the mall by the army recruit. Told him, if you wanna go to school, we got money too. Sign up at 18, you'll be out when you're 22. He joined the army airborne, got his uniform with the boot camp. Got some discipline, I rock, that's where they shipping them.
Whoa, when I heard him and his singing, I was just totally blown away.
I listened listen to that. I listen to Robert Johnson and Nina Simone and Nat King Cole. You know, isn't it great after being out late, walking my baby back home, arm in arm over meadow and farm, walking my baby back home.
And my suggestion is that maybe he go old school and put down an album of him singing.
We go along harmonizing a song, or I'm reciting a poem. Pals go by and they give me the eye, walking my baby back home. Like, that was lyrics. That was like, you didn't have to say, I want to get in your booty, girl, in your booty, girl, get in your booty, girl. It was like, yo, you can actually, like, infer something and know what he's talking about.
Cannot wait to listen to the rest of the stream, and great stuff.
This is Caleb from Alabama. I'm calling to ask y'all to stop using the word twee. I don't know what that word means. Thanks.
No more messages.
To give us your opinion on Sound Opinions, call our hotline, 1-888-859-1800. We'll be back next week with Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media.